For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good morning and welcome. I'm very happy to have been in the talk this morning to Paul Lazarz, our Enzo and physician, and also a member of our board. So thank you very much, Paul.
Thank you, Taigen. So, after much discussion about what to talk about today, we kind of collectively settled on the subject of money. In Buddhism, in Zen Buddhism, it's always a very hard topic for people to broach and for people to really grapple with. I'm not afraid to talk about money. I'll give you a little bit of background for my life in regards to money. I was raised in a working-class neighborhood on the southwest side of Chicago where basically most people felt like they didn't really have any money. And then through a course of events, I started working down at the futures exchanges downtown, the Chicago Board of Trade, Chicago Mercantile Exchange, at its heyday, honestly, where money was flowing like wine out of a... There was just so much money everywhere, and most of it was in cash, and most of it was being thrown around like crazy, where there were a lot of people down there who had an awful lot of money. And then my life kind of evolved to be somewhere in between those two extremes. So in many ways, I feel that through the course of that journey, I had to grapple with issues about money, just like everybody else has to. And I do feel that through the practice itself, I got to a place that might be somewhat comfortable engaging with thoughts of money and how to deal with money. So I wanted to touch upon some of those things today. Hopefully you'll find some of it helpful, or hopefully it'll help to spur a good conversation about this topic after the talk. Historically in Buddhism, and I think this is what most Americans are attracted to, there's a leave-taking, a leaving from home, a leaving from your life, a leaving from material possessions to go off on the spiritual path. And it can almost seem like a very individual path because we picture the Buddha under the lotus tree reaching enlightenment after a six-year journey of leaving everything behind that he once knew. But again, as Buddhism evolved in India and, of course, with its move to China and Japan and Korea, lay people became involved. And obviously, every person can't just leave home and walk away from all their responsibilities. And that's probably even more so now in our modern society. In our American society, it could actually be frowned upon to do something like that. So requirements and discussion about lay people were brought up in the very beginning stages of Buddha's development when Shakyamuni, the historical Buddha, was still alive. And of course, lay people at that point were called householders. And he spoke often about the responsibilities that householders had, even though he himself chose to choose a somewhat, I will say monastic path, even though it wasn't a monastic path at that time. He acknowledged that people get born into conditions and that there's a karmic action at work in everybody's life. And if you're in a position where maybe your heart is drawn to Buddhism, where you do have a family, a wife, you might be a son or a daughter to aging parents, you might have career responsibilities, that it's okay to maintain your practice within those responsibilities, and it actually could be irresponsible not to. And then he did set out some guidelines about respect for parents, caring for children, respect for spouses. And then, of course, we all know in the Eightfold Path, which is the instruction he laid out on how to follow in his footsteps, right livelihood is also a very important part of the Buddhist path, meaning engaging in the right type of career in order to walk the spiritual path. So within that context, it's important to understand what your relationship is to money and how you feel about it, so that you can maybe get your ducks in order in that regard. With Buddhism, we always talk about the middle way. So again, the Buddha spoke about not giving in to extremes, and having money or not having money represent those two extremes. We know that people who don't have money can't really follow a spiritual path because they're hungry, and they have nowhere to sleep, they don't have clothes for their back, and they're living in discomfort and want all the time. So until our basic human needs are met, it's very hard to turn our attention to spiritual matters. We even acknowledge this in monastic practice. That's why the job of Tenzo is considered a very important function in a monastic community, because enlightened people throughout the ages acknowledge that if a stomach is not full, it's very hard to sit in zazen. Even though sometimes in our mind we think of doing without. But the Buddha knew, and most spiritual practitioners throughout the ages in Buddhism knew, that a full belly went a very long way to being able to sit zazen and turn your attention to spiritual matters. So the extremism of denial is maybe not really the path to go. And then we also know through Buddhist teachings that excessive wealth isn't necessarily the best condition for the Buddhist path either. Basically, because we know desire is the cause of all suffering. With excessive wealth, we tend to have a lot of material possessions. With material possessions, there comes a lot of responsibility in maintaining those possessions. With excessive wealth, there comes a sense of security and control over your life, where we know impermanence is actually the seed of our life. So you can become very deluded if you're very wealthy that is not the case. Because we all know as human beings, the more wealth you have, the more control you do have over the conditions in your life. So leaning to that extreme with money probably isn't the best thing either in regards to following a spiritual path. But just like in all relationships, there's a complexity to money. And zazen gives us a perfect opportunity to kind of sit with how we feel about it. I like to think of money in two ways. As something I have a relationship with, just like any person, just like any family member, just like any friend, just like any task or job. And then also, it's a form of energy that helps us move through action in the world. Instead of it being something that I can grab onto and hold onto. Because really, it's not that. Coins and paper is just a symbol of something else. So sitting with that and thinking about that and seeing how we respond to that idea is one way to understand how we feel about money and our relationship to it. I think it's important to be honest on how you feel. I have friends who, at one point in their life, were very poor, or maybe left home at a very young age, and worked really hard, and now they're very wealthy. And they're really honest, like, you know what? I hated being poor, and I never want to be poor again. I like my things, and I'm going to work hard to maintain them. They're honest with where they're at in their relationship to money, and they acknowledge that it's something that's important in their life, it's in their life, and they're not ready to let that go. And there's nothing wrong with that, because we each have to meet our life with where we're at a given time. And just like our relationship with money can be complex, we have to acknowledge that our relationships and responsibilities to the people around us are also very complex. For example, a young person could get married, have children, start a career, and in the middle of all that, have a sense of bodhicitta arise in them, meaning the sense that they are attracted to Buddhist practice. But at the point that bodhicitta arises, they can't just backpedal out of their life and say, well, I'm married, but I don't care. I'm going to do without. Well, I have a house and I have children I have to support. Well, I don't care. I'm not going to worry about what my income is going to be. We all know that's not realistic. So we have to acknowledge that the complexity of our life will put us in a position where we might have to make very hard decisions about the amount of money we need and follow career goals in order to meet those needs so that we could also provide for the other people in our lives. And we have to acknowledge that some of those people don't want to live a certain way. So if you have responsibility to some people in life, maybe you could do without certain things, but they just don't feel they can't. And you're part of a team trying to provide certain things to the family unit. So there has to be a fine balance between that. And we have to acknowledge where we're at in that relationship and in that balance when we engage with spiritual practice and when we think about the need for money in our personal lives. We also need to be aware of the cultural influence. I know in Buddhist circles, you know, we look at capitalism as kind of the other. It's like some kind of other. But we need to acknowledge the fact, I believe, that we are part of the system, whether we agree with it or not, whether we try to do things personally in our life that don't feel capitalistic, we still benefit in many ways, no matter how simple our life is, from the capitalism that we were born into. But we need to acknowledge that capitalism has its own goals and functions, and that we're privy to the influence of those goals and functions as we move through our life. And the easy example is advertising. You know, we have to acknowledge how deeply advertising can affect us. And good advertisers know how to appeal to us on many levels, not only consciously, but subconsciously. Zazen helps us become very aware of how we can engage with subtle influences in our life. And we need to really understand, I believe, when those subtle influences are playing on us. And we have to try to make wise, skillful decisions in the middle of all that. And of course, that's not anything that's easy to do, but we have the tool with sitting meditation, where we become very aware just of our environment around us and how affected we are by sitting next to people, even though we're not even engaged with them, what we feel is engaged. But you actually, if the more you sit, and if you do session, you realize that you know a lot about everybody in the room, even though you're not staring at them and you're not turning to talk to them during the course of it. So we become aware that we can be influenced in many ways, and we become very aware of being fully present in our life with those influences. But at the same time, I feel it's important that we avoid condemnation because it creates an other. And the most important thing for us is to engage with our community, to engage to the larger society that we live in. So anytime we can't accept that we're part of this system, in a way we're eliminating people we feel are. So no real change can happen unless people can openly speak to each other about the reality of their lives. And if we create an other, then we immediately make somebody defensive. We're very used to thinking of others being created on the downtrodden side of the spectrum, but we tend not to think that others are being created on the upside and excessive side of the spectrum, because we feel those others have everything. So it's hard to understand how there might be suffering within that extreme as well. And we have to be, if we're walking the middle way, we have to be open to the fact that we can engage with the suffering on this end, but that we could also openly engage with the suffering on this end. Because we know suffering is suffering. And it's unfair to put judgments on what suffering actually is. If we want to engage openly with each person that comes across our path. Our Bodhisattva way tells us that we want to help everybody reach enlightenment. So we have to acknowledge that we want to help everybody along that spectrum, which sometimes could be a little more difficult to do when it's not so obvious how that suffering might be present. And I always, and this is part of my journey too at capitalism, because I used to grapple also with there must be a better way. Because again, I was immersed in the excesses of it on many levels. And I would give it a lot of thought, and I still give it thought on occasion, but I really haven't come up with a better way. So I like to joke about it. Until I could come up with a better way of how to deal with economic issues, I'm going to be careful in my criticism. I have here, got a better way? ? Prove it. Anyway. And now I want to just move off of that and talk again about the relationship between monastics and lay people. There's a lot to be learned within that relationship, and our spiritual practice almost relies on that relationship for us to develop certain aspects of it. Originally, the monastics never handled money at all, and they were given a dana bowl or a begging bowl to meet the needs for their meals. So that would mean you would receive a begging bowl or dana bowl as part of your ordination or acceptance into the order. And the monks and monastics would go out at certain periods of the day. I believe it was only once a day, one meal a day. And they would put out the bowl, and lay people who were in society would put food in the bowl. And whatever was put in the bowl had to be eaten, whether it was spoiled food, great food. And I do believe, like, even monks take a vow of not eating meat, but I believe if someone puts meat in your dana bowl, and Taigen could speak to this, you were supposed to eat the meat because it was a gift that was given and you didn't want to deny someone's generosity. So what I'm saying about denying someone's generosity, it's important for people to be allowed to give. For people who might feel their karmic conditions don't allow them to lead a monastic life, it's important they're contributing in some way. And oftentimes, when people have very complex lives, or if they are in positions of influence in other areas of our society and they don't have time for this kind of lifestyle, it's important that they know that they could support it. So it's our job as practitioners to accept that generosity, so that they can partake in the spiritual path. On the other side of it, when we accept that generosity, there's a humility to it. So, and if you disagree with me, you know, always in discussion you could say that, because in our culture, humility is kind of a bad word. And being humble is a bad word. And I'll speak to humility because I do own my own business. And I'm very grateful that people continue to pay a tuition every month to me. And I always get emotional talking about this, because if it wasn't for them, I couldn't do what I love to do. If it wasn't for them, I couldn't be sitting here right now giving the Dharma talk, because I wouldn't have time to focus my life on spiritual practice the way I do. And I'm very aware of the fact that people support me very consistently throughout time, without arguing with me, without rebutting. I am providing them a service with the Kung Fu, but they also want some of this as well. And they do have a respect for what I'm doing and a gratitude in itself that a space is being provided for them to explore certain things, even though it's technically a business. So that's what I mean about expanding your thinking about what is what and this is that. There's a lot of gray area between, you know, what's a religious organization, what's providing a service, what is a business. If we think creatively about these things, we could see that we can engage in spiritual practice and have spiritual evolution if we just expand our thinking a little bit. But anyway, this humility plays a very important role for me in my spiritual practice because it makes me realize there are greater things out there than myself. It makes me realize that I need other people. I need other people. Otherwise, my life right now, I wouldn't have a place to sleep. I wouldn't be able to eat. I wouldn't be able to get medical care if I didn't have people supporting me. And there's a gratitude in that and an awareness when you engage with other people. You automatically engage with them with more respect because you need them. Let's just put it there. So you're not as quick to, blah, 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 blah. Well, whatever, I don't need this crap, you know. You're not as quick to do that. And then it also allows me to realize that I can learn things from other people, too. The humility comes in with that. So it's easier to engage with teachers and to engage with other people who have experience in other areas, not only spiritually, but in other areas of my life that I might not be as well versed in. It's easier for me to engage with them and get some of their expertise. Moving into that, now I want to be very practical. Because again, at Ancient Dragon, I've always been the person, I'm not afraid to talk about money. So I just want to stress, if you can't find ways to engage in that fashion in the larger society, we're right here. And this place also can't stay open without the support of many people, not only people who walk through the door, but we also have a lot of support from people who don't live in Chicago, maybe did it one time, but don't anymore, but they still believe in the practice that we have here. They believe how important it is to support it, and they continue to do that. We also get support from people who know Tigan from the times he lived in California and believe in his teachings and what he's trying to do in Chicago and still support him financially. We get support from people who engage with his books. We get support from people who just walk in and put something in the Donna Bowl. And we get support from monthly membership for people who do kind of come consistently and feel giving a little bit every month helps, because we all know if you know you have a steady income, it helps you pay the rent. But with all of that being said, not everybody has money, so I want to encourage you, if there are ways that you could give to the Sangha, that, again, money is just energy. So if you could give by being part of the ritual forms and learning how to do that, if you could help with providing things for the kitchen, if you could help with marketing or graphic design, if you could help by taking photographs when we have events, any way that anybody can contribute, it all counts. Because again, money is not separate from the energy of action. It's just a way of manifesting action in the world. I think that's all I really want to say about that, and I think it would be a good time to open it up to discussion, and if anybody has anything they would like to add or rebut or any questions, I'm here. I'm open. Thank you for giving me your ears, like the Romans would say.
Well, thank you for raising different aspects of all these important questions and the energy of comments, responses, questions, other perspectives. Please feel free.
Everything is, you know, incomplete. be suffering and permanent. And I think David Lloyd, who will be coming here in a few weeks, talks about this sort of lack that Westerners feel all the time. And if we aren't in touch with it in any given moment, we can become in touch with it by just sort of settling a little bit. And advertising has found a way to totally capitalize, no pun intended, on it by telling us, well, this will fix your that feeling of lack. And so we try this and we try that. And maybe practice is one place to come and realize that there's no end to that, grasping after something that's going to fill that lack. But I also was thinking about how much suffering there is in having money and certain seeking after it and feeling, even once you have it, there's this feeling of fear of losing it and all the things that people feel like they need to go through to maintain, that money and that status. And it seems, sometimes like you're saying, that couldn't possibly be so bad, but, in just talking with people who seem like they have a lot, it's sometimes I notice that there is this feeling of constant tension of, how do I maintain this lifestyle? And so I think both things, for me kind of speak to how important it is to find, a place to relax with all of those issues. They need to, you need to have enough so that you can live and practice, but having too much or too little brings a lot of tension. It's hard to find peace.
Thank you. Yeah, there's the concept now that we're moving into technology taking a lot of jobs away, or possibly taking a lot of jobs away down the road, of guaranteed income. And there's some of you might be even more familiar with it than me. But in a sense, I imagine, everyone will get taxed, it goes through the government, and then everybody gets a check. But this is it. With communism and socialism, though, everybody's individual life is different, though. So what's a guaranteed income for each individual? Like, how do you have a criteria that determines, especially, and I always go to this, especially if someone's taking care of other people, And now I'm thinking, what popped in my mind right away is, what if you have aging parents and they're in a senior facility? Everybody knows how much money you need with that. So it's not just one fix in one area of the society. It's a lot of different things that have to kind of be fixed in concert with each other. So just very complex issues. Hi. It's good to see you.
Thanks for your talk. I think the talking about other forms of economies and talking about the capitalism that we live in, naturally can lead to discussions of socialist experiments, which have a very complicated relationship with Buddhism because of the historical circumstances of so many of the so many socialist revolutions and countries being situated in Asia, and those countries having policies of doing away with religion, and in their circumstances, Buddhism. And I think certainly no country that has tried to follow a socialist model has been entirely successful or perfect. But I think there are some examples. For instance, Cuba is a small nation with relatively few resources. And yet, because of these socialist principles, they're able to ensure medical care for everyone in the country and achieve infant mortality rates superior to folks that exist in the black community in the south side of Chicago, for instance. Also during hurricanes and natural disasters, the same kind of principles allow resources to be mobilized and people to be organized so that they have almost no deaths due to hurricanes based on the same principles. And so something that I think about is, although the people following those principles in Cuba almost certainly are not thinking of their actions as, from any Buddhist perspective, and may even be hostile to the concept of organizing life or looking at life from a spiritual lens in any way. I sometimes challenge myself to see the spirit of the Bodhisattva vow in some of those actions.
Thank you.
I second what you said. Cuban doctors are going to other countries in the Caribbean now, much more than doctors from any other country, to help with people with more pain that comes. So, there's no easy answers to any of this, but it's almost certain is that from each according to his ability, each according to his need, which is a larger principle, that happens best in the monastery. So anyway, these questions are how we work with them and how we work with money. Money is complicated. I can appreciate the reasons.
I went glasses shopping yesterday. Okay. I was only planning on spending a little bit of money, and I actually had to spend way more money than I thought I did, but at some point during the transaction I thought, well, that's a basic necessity, I kind of have to pay for that, don't I? Like, I can't, I'm practically blind without these, and I need better prescription glasses, these are falling apart, the coating's falling off, it's scratched, this is getting scratched, but I find myself in a very different economic situation than I did growing up. Because I also grew up, as you know, working class Southwest South Chicago.
Same neighborhood.
And I've become increasingly more aware of my changing socioeconomic cultural situation. I've moved up the ladder, at least a few rungs or two. But sitting with my practice here, like, I've actually sort of just come up for me, what am I assuming is a basic necessity? What am I assuming it's owed to me or that I deserve as a result of my changing circumstances? It's sort of like an underlying question that's come up about money, but also, in relation to what privileges I do have in the intersections that I coexist in. What kind of privileges, do I have as being male, as being Asian, in the racial spectrum of the U.S.? What do I think I'm owed or deserved in these circumstances? And I think it's a really good question for me to have sort of just like in the background, so I don't assume certain things more that I need to have more than other people, or that I have some kind of that I behave in such a way that betray some kind of superiority based on what I think I'm owed or deserved. So that's my relationship to money.
Thank you.
Yes, sort of following on some of the other things, I think that it's important for us, specifically as Buddhists, to be sort of maintain a sort of critical awareness at sort of all levels. And so cause that brought it about, but it, like all other phenomena, it's a conditioned kind of thing. And then, so that there are, maybe some ways in which it's beneficial, but there are other ways in which it obviously perpetuates forms of, suffering. And so I think we need to be thinking in these very big terms about basic economic possibilities and what will serve people in general the best. At a smaller scale, I agree with this, what you said, people often say, money is a form of energy. Just like we can say that, technology is manifests certain kinds of energy, power manifests certain kinds of energy. The thing to keep in mind is that they're very, very, when we put it in those terms, they always sound neutral, but the actual expressions are rarely neutral. So that even within the context, if we sort of say, okay, for the moment, we live under a system of capitalist arrangements, and that's sort of the reality of how we have to find a way to live, I think it's still incumbent on Buddhists to like be thinking very clearly about all of their actions within that context, because some, if managed skillfully, can bring about benefits, and some obviously cause harms. So, just like with technology, we treat it as a neutral thing. I don't believe that. I think it's, certain technologies, if we engage in them, they enforce and cultivate certain behaviors, and that's just the nature of things. But we owe it to ourselves, and we owe it as Bodhisattva practitioners to everybody else to be, always evaluating and making mistakes, surely, but sort of doing our best to make sure that whatever sort of modes we're acting through express our underlying Buddhist commitments.
Thank you.
One point I wanted to make, just in agreement with people, about not demonizing people who are extremely wealthy, which can happen when we're trying to support people who are oppressed. Just because I know that there are people who have resources who are very conservative and responsible about trying to use them beneficially.
Yes.
So, just to say that. Are there any other comments? This is a difficult. Yes, right.
Thank you for bringing up so many different ways in which a relationship to money can be ground for practice. One of the ways that I thought of when you were talking about money is, again, it's energy. I often thought, I do these activities, and it translates into food on my table, or a roof over my head. Those activities—that's what it does. And the money is sort of just this means in between. And when you said that, I thought, well, this energy is empty, and it's—everything's empty, and it's money is empty, and especially nowadays, in the sense that it's just numbers on the screen. These ephemeral numbers on screen, and it's entirely dependent on relationships all the way from, the world economic situation and the value of the dollar can go way down. All kinds of things can happen. But, my relationship with my kids, they may need a whole lot of money all of a sudden, and suddenly I have another. It's all very fluid, and therefore there's no security ultimately. And I think part of the problem is culture is that it's so centered around money, and ultimately it's empty. And maybe we keep discovering that maybe through crises, or we suspect it, and it drives us to seek it at security even more. And it never works. And I think that money is a great way to practice with emptiness, about insecurity. Just how do I live when there's nothing really ultimately to hold on to? Money is just a good place challenged by that all the time. Whether it's personal finances or a group or your business or whatever. How do I live in that insecurity?
Speaking of, yeah. So growing up with want, when I started working, I needed that paycheck, man. I needed it for years and years and years and years. I could not live without a steady paycheck because I was terrified that, you know, everything would fall out. And I will say Buddhist practice enabled me to open a business, practicing over years. And I didn't do sitting meditation up until I came to Ancient Dragon. So, I mean, just the Eightfold Path and the idea of impermanence. But exploring what impermanence meant and getting a little more grounded through other practices in my life, you know, stable and grounded, I was able to open the business. And part of opening it was a challenge to my practice. Like, can you really live with impermanence? Can you just put up a sign, open a door, and wait and see what happens? Or are you just talking about it, you know? And it's deepened my practice very much, and there really isn't anything to worry about. But I still grapple with that every single month. I still feel no one's going to show up or whatever the case is going to be. So impermanence right there, and you're right, money is empty, but that's the key, that dealing with the impermanence of our situation and the illusion that it's something else when it's not.
Somehow this what Brian's been reminding me of the extreme case of impermanence, which we've all seen in the last couple of weeks in Houston and Texas and Florida, that the fires in the Northwest that for a lot of people suddenly everything can go. I don't know if there's anybody here who has know people who have experienced some kind of loss. So what you were saying, Ryan, about there's energy and there's emptiness. So this is a deep topic.
I don't know tons of business owners, but the few that I have gotten to know, most of them have been very proud of the fact that they provide jobs. And for them, that means a lot to them. And they take a responsibility for the people working for them as well when they make decisions. So,
no. Oh, thank you again for just raising all these issues.
Thank you.
For-